Beaming out across the galaxy, this is where conspiracy on the wild side meets the perspective of a lifetime. This is the Free Zone with your host, Freeman.
Hello and welcome to the Free Zone. Well, it's not feeling so free these days. I mean, everyone is quite aware of false flag attacks. This has become history. We know these things happen. Now, as we're standing in front of what seems to be a Muslim versus homosexual shootout in Orlando, at the same time we're dealing with the Bilderberg meeting, we have a situation where they're equating this to Pearl Harbor and 9/11. And I could think of no one better than Jim Fetzer to come and tell us and help us discuss what is going on at the Pulse Club in Orlando, where now it is reported 50 are dead and 53 injured. There's already mysteries all about this. We're going to get deep into this. Jim Fetzer, you can catch him all the time. Get on over and check out The Real Deal. You'll get a live video broadcast hosting all the ideas and great thoughts that Jim has brought forward and has had banned from Amazon. He also hosts The Raw Deal. And if you want to pick up his books, check them out at moonrockbooks.com. You can find everything from Jim at jimfetzer.blogspot.com as well, so that you can keep tabs on these amazing times, because we are sitting in a situation right now where we can see clearly that history is being written, that the script is being changed, and that what really is coming under fire from all that we're looking at is the Constitution. So we're going to look deep into all of this right now and get deep into this with Jim Fetzer. So thank you for coming on with us here tonight.
Oh, terrific, Freeman. Yeah, the Orlando situation is unbelievable, both literally and figuratively.
Yeah, that's the situation that we sit at. I mean, okay, let's go ahead and just open with the concept that your book, No One Died at Sandy Hook, was banned straight out of Amazon, and you have now had to, well, you're just giving it away for free because you know this data is important.
Well, you're right. When Amazon banned the book, I just coincidentally was going on with Jeff Rentz that night and made the decision to release it for free as a PDF, which a lot of places have picked up. So then a friend of mine who's been following this has said that he's noticed millions of people looking for the book, but that Google periodically adjusts as the numbers downward, so people aren't aware how much it's in demand. It happened after Jay Carney, who was White House spokesman, had gone to Amazon as senior vice president. The book was actually released for sale on the 22nd of October. It had sold nearly 500 copies before it was banned on 19 November. After I released it, I suspect that it's had millions of readers, although I would have originally estimated it would sell 4,000 to 8,000 copies. I've been able to find a new publisher happily, and it's now available along with my Boston book and an earlier one about the moon landings at moonrockbooks.com.
Fantastic. Yes. I mean, we are seeing this right now, and we are seeing a host of reports coming out from these false flags, crisis actors. It's been quite a show. I mean, from the time of the Aurora shooting into Sandy Hook, and of course, you know, numerous others. And we can see that there is a script. Now, it was so simple for us to predict that Miley Cyrus would come out with pansexuality, that after they had splashed the White House in rainbow colors for homosexual weddings, that this Muslim versus homosexual situation would come to a head. And now here we are with the exact same scenarios, crazy, you know, madness. They're equating this to every worst attack that has ever happened on this continent.
Well, it's completely ridiculous. I mean, among the signs that something was wrong at Sandy Hook, there was no surge of EMTs into the building, no string of ambulances to rush the little bodies off to hospitals where they could be declared to be dead or alive. No medevac helicopter was called. In fact, the road was so clogged that if you'd actually wanted to get an emergency vehicle down Dickinson Drive, it was physically impossible. even photographs, aerial photographs, reveal the scam, because it was a 28 degree ground temperature day. You should have seen heat and steam rising from the building. But it had actually been closed by 2008. The school was loaded with asbestos and other biohazards. It had been damaged by past hurricanes. It was in such terrible condition that to bring it into conformity with the state and federal laws regarding Americans with Disability Acts would have been extremely expensive. So they made the determination then to shut it down. They were using it for storage. If you look at the aerial photographs, you'll notice immediately the absence of the familiar blue and white painted parking areas and the blue and white signage. You'll see that there's a wooden stairway, for example, as an exit that would not be wheelchair accessibility. In that instance, it even has a piece of steel pipe sticking out that could pop the eye of a little kid. This was a kindergarten through fourth grade school. And if you look at the rows of vehicles in the middle, you'll see they're not properly parked. They're all parked facing the building, but the driving instructions require you come in, turn right, curl around, park facing away from the building. But since they were simply serving as props, they found it simpler just to bring them all in a straight line and put them in two by two by two. Much simpler, yes, but for the discerning eye, if you're paying attention, you can realize this is a major discrepancy. So the fact there's no heat or steam rising from the building is indicative that it was a cold school. There wasn't any classroom activity taking place at all. And believe it or not, Freeman, we've even got in the book two chapters of 50 photographs each, one of the furnishing of the Lanza home to serve as a prop. It appears to have been an empty house. It was in a high-value real estate area, but they put cheap furniture in. You can see Adam Lanza's room messy, Adam Lanza's room neat. I mean, they were trying to figure out the best way to present it. And when you get up to the one of the most interesting photographs is of the Nancy Lanza bedroom where Adam allegedly shot her four times in the head with a .22 caliber rifle, remarkably leaving no fingerprints whatsoever on the weapon. And if you look at the bed, you see there's a little red stuff there, but it doesn't look like blood. It looks to me like it might be raspberry jam. There's a wooden chest there that has papers on it, which we found in other photographs because they were keeping records of how they were furnishing the room. And the keen eye of Kelly Watt, who has her own commercial and home cleaning business, she spotted a blue moving pad under the leg of the bed that in their haste they'd forgotten to remove. In chapter 7, it's even more devastating because we have 50 photographs of them refurbishing the school to serve as a prop. We even have the moving vans there. We have the nameplates for the classroom that still have the moving van sticker on them. And the classic is that the SWAT team vehicle is there. And if you look over the top, there's a row of four windows in classroom 10. Which are undamaged, but later, after the presumptive event would be shown to be shot out, especially the second window in, but it's undamaged here. The flag is at full mast. If you look down below, you see there's crime scene tape up for a crime that is yet to be committed. And Wayne Carver, the medical examiner, is leaning against a wall with his arms folded, waiting for the arrival of his portable mortuary tent. Now, we have other photographs that show the difference between the windows undamaged and the windows damaged, and of the perps actually drilling fake bullet holes in the window frame to simulate shots that were never fired, where they're all exactly 90 degrees to the window pane and exactly parallel with one another. I'm a former Marine Corps officer. I used to supervise recruit training at San Diego and Edson Range, and I with 15 DIs and 300 recruits, and I'll tell you, this is obviously unreal. No actual shooting would have yielded this result. So we have all that, including the photograph of the perps drilling the holes for Sandy Hook. Now, one of the key signs of both Sandy Hook and the Boston bombing, Freeman, is that there was no string of ambulances. I mean, you'd think immediately you've got 20 kids, 6 adults, you got to have the string of ambulance. Boston bombing, the numbers went up as high as 160 or more that were alleged to have been injured. No string of ambulance. Again, Orlando, 50 police cars, but no string of ambulances. which is all indicative that this is something completely wrong, that people aren't actually injured here, because they can't divert bona fide medical resources for a fake event, a staged event. It could very well be that others need those resources, and therefore you might cost the life of a real person by doing it. I mean, if we run through the official account about Orlando, even on its face, it seems very peculiar, because you got this gay bar or club where there's supposed to be 50 dead and 53 injured. You got a Muslim shooter who's calling out Allah Akbar. He's supposed to be using an AR-15, which, of course, is an assault rifle. It's a civilian version. It's not actually fully automatic, but semi. You have to pull the trigger each time to fire a round. You can't just depress the trigger and have it continue to fire continuously. He allegedly made a 911 call to the police pledging his fealty to ISIS. He is claimed to be inspired by the Boston bombing. Well, let me just interject a word there before I continue with this list. I mean, the Boston bombing, again, was supposed to have been done by Muslims, two Muslim brothers. But we know the whole thing was fake. We had the police on bullhorns calling out, "This is a drill. This is a drill." We had the Boston Globe tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities. A second tweet saying one will be set off in 1 minute in front of the library. And lo and behold, 1 minute later, one of these explosions goes off in front of the Boston Public Library. You have a lot of noise and smoke. I'm a former artillery officer, and I can assure you those were puff pieces. They didn't have enough explosive force to kill anyone. When you look through the smoke, you see there are bodies there with missing limbs, but Freeman, there's no blood. As Lorraine Day, MD, who is the chief of trauma surgery for San Francisco General Hospital for 25 years, has observed, this is a physiological impossibility. You cannot have limbs blown off by an explosion and there be no blood. In fact, it's a while before the blood starts to show up, and it's much too bright to be real blood. It's Hollywood blood. It came out of tubes. Interestingly, Nathan Foulkes, who's a Hollywood producer-director, identified one of the key players, a tall guy in a cowboy hat, as an actor he'd cast in one of his own films. His name is Carlos Arredondo. And he suggested to me, and it was the first time I'd heard the idea, that they actually use a smoke machine. And would you believe, Freeman, we searched through the photographic record, we found a studio-grade smoke machine. It was such a significant discovery, I put a photograph of it on the back cover of the book, and nobody died in Boston either, where actually, you know, in terms of the marathon bombing itself, nobody died. There are three persons who may have died. One is an MIT security guard who's supposed to have been shot by Zokar, but where in fact it looks as though once he discovered he was being sought, that he knew this guy and was interested in turning himself in. So he was shot, and it was claimed that Zokar had done it. Then his brother winds up dead. We have photographs of his body with a huge gash in the side. And it's claimed that Zokar did it, but he died after he was taken into police custody. So how could Zokar have killed his brother after he'd been taken into police custody? In fact, we have a witness saying she watched the police drive over him three times in an SUV, which appears to be his own vehicle. And then to blame it on Zokar, completely absurd. And get this, we have photographs. This is part of the government's own evidence of the two brothers at the marathon. Now, I learned from his aunt, Morette, that these images of them at the marathon had been photoshopped, especially because it showed the older brother, Tamerlan, clean shaven. And she explained to me that he had a beard. And I asked if she could prove it. She started sending me all this evidence, photograph of him lying in bed with his cat. He has a beard, a link to a video at a gymnasium where he and his brother were working out before the shooting, the bombing. He had a beard. A friend of theirs actually contacted him after the marathon bombing, relieved to discover he'd been nowhere in the vicinity. They had dinner together that night. He had a beard. Then a surveillance tape from inside a convenience store where Zokar's inside Tamerlan out. He has a beard. Then when he's taken into arrest, we actually have photographs where the police strip him naked and put him in the back car. If you get unblurred images, you can see he has a beard, even in the photograph of his body. He's still got a beard. But get this, Freeman, it's even worse than that. I mean, this shows how incompetent these people are. According to the FBI report that and photographs, we have ample proof, the backpacks that blew up were black nylon backpacks. That's in the FBI's official report. It's also in the indictment for Zucker in the court in Boston, where this complete show trial had no authenticity whatsoever was conducted. From the photographs we have of them, you can see their backpacks. Neither of them is wearing a black nylon backpack. So that I consulted a retired professor of law, John Remington Graham, about the significance of our evidence and what he thought was most important. And he said the fact that the backpacks don't match mean there wasn't even probable cause for an arrest, much less an indictment or a conviction at a trial. So even in staging this event, Freeman, they got sloppy about it, very careless. We actually know who the perps were. This case was cracked by the alternative media already the night that it had occurred by discovering all these Kraft International personnel in khaki trousers, black jackets, black baseball caps with a skull insignia, where the motto of Kraft is violence does solve problems. We have photographs of two of these guys heading toward the location where one of the backpacks blew up. One is wearing a black nylon backpack with a white square. The backpack that blows up is a black nylon backpack with a white square. We have other of him rushing away, no longer carrying the black nylon backpack with a white square. I mean, this is completely ridiculous and absurd. So, that you know, all my research on this subject, by the way, is collaborative. When I did Sandy Hook, for example, I brought together a dozen different experts, including six PhD, current or retired college professors, which is significant because a PhD is a research degree. It certifies that you're competent to conduct scholarly research in your area of expertise. But of course, that has a general outreach. I mean, my own PhD is in the history and the philosophy of science. But I've done a huge amount of research on these subjects especially since I retired in 2006 after a 35-year career offering principally courses in logic, critical thinking, and scientific reasoning. Similarly, with the Boston bombing, I brought together another dozen experts, including, again, six current or retired PhD professors, and even have a contribution from Paul Craig Roberts, who was talking about the findings of the professor of law. And where Paul Craig Roberts is perhaps our nation's leading public intellectual. So, you know, I have a great deal of background here. I mean, some of our contributors, one Dr. Eelwin, who maintains the Fellowship of the Minds website, had published 80 articles on Sandy Hook before I edited the collection. I myself had published 20 articles on Sandy Hook before I edited the collection. And because I'm doing my video show, The Real Deal, on Media Broadcasting Center, MBC, I had been doing a lot of shows about the Boston bombing and Sandy Hook, two of the classics you can find online, entitled The Real Deal Must-See Special Sandy Hook Update and The Real Deal Special Must-See Boston Bombing Update. I don't think anyone who views either of those, where they're less than an hour long apiece, could have any doubt that both of those were staged events. So when we now turn to Orlando and we see some of the telling signs already, such as the absence of any string of ambulances, lots of police vehicles, but no ambulances, we have to be very suspicious. Indeed, it turns out, of course, this is taking place in Florida, which is a swing state, very important state. The mayor of Orlando turns out to be an adamant opponent of guns, so he's an enthusiastic anti-gun guy. We've had interviews already by, for example, an Israeli Defense Force anti-terrorist expert who talked about how if this had happened in Israel, the gunman would have been shot dead within moments, implying that if you had more security or more guns present, that it would have made a difference. In fact, the Donald has already observed about Paris, for example, that if the citizens had been armed, that it would have made a real difference, about which I think there can be no serious doubt. Now, the club in this instance, Paul's, is a gun-free zone. But that means that they were inspecting people who came in for whether they had any weapons or not. It was hot in Florida. This is the summer, after all. People are relatively scantily clad. It's not like winter where you might be in a northern state bundled up with all kinds of coats. So it's questionable how this guy could possibly have got into the club in the first place. And then we have a former Israeli ambassador to the United States, Michael Oren, who's saying that this event is going to help Donald Trump, actually, ironically, in relation to all these events. But the reason why it's problematic for Obama include that this guy is not a white or a Christian, but he's a person of color and a Muslim. He's not a Republican, but a Democrat. He purchased his firearms legally. In fact, he had a couple of permits. He had a Class D license, which is given to security guards, and a Class G license, which is a general concealed carry. Both were legal and not set to expire until September 2017. So that Obama goes out of his way to try to focus on the good parts for him, which are that it involved guns and gays, because this is supposed to be disrespectful of gays. And of course, we need to ban these weapons that are causing these events, and doesn't talk about the fact that, and he even says that his motivation is unclear, which is absurd. I mean, even according to the official count, he was calling out Allah Akbar, which of course is Arabic for God is great. God is great. And I'll comment more on that and some other aspects of this. But let me just say, Obama's ignoring the fact that Islam is very antagonistic toward homosexuality. I mean, I'm looking right now at a statement made by an Islamic cleric in his declaration, the punishment for homosexuality is death. Well, Obama would never admit that. In fact, Obama isn't even acknowledging the guy's Muslim. Obama is not even willing to use the phrase Islamic terrorism. I mean, something seriously wrong here, Freeman. And this just opens up a whole can of worms, I think, across a wide range of issues.
Absolutely. You know, this is how we get to what they are after. This is how we start to understand where this game plan is going. And, you know, right now, Hillary's on CNN talking about lone wolves being a priority and they need to prevent online radicalization. And a lot of the things that you're saying with the mysterious, the people that perhaps did die in these situations. I mean, in Sandy Hook, obviously, I could not see any evidence to anyone dying in Sandy Hook while I watched that happening. Now, we go back all the way to Waco, back to the Clintons again, and you have that one character laying on the roof being shot at. And back in 96, I guess that was, we witnessed that the three shots coming out of the Waco building were from Clinton's bodyguards, who were now FEMA agents or ATF agents going into the building and being shot by their own man.
Freeman, we have aerial footage of the Waco event. You can see automatic weapons fire coming from outside, from the FBI agents and ATF into the building. They actually initiated the fire of the building. They burned alive, 150 children and adults. And it was just because they were eccentric in terms of their religious beliefs. David Koresh, whom they claimed they were after, regularly walked from the compound into town. They could have picked him up anytime they wanted. They didn't have to burn down the compound. Something bizarre was going on there.
Right.
And Hillary, now you see the political motivation is coming out because the idea is supposed to be this radicalization through the internet. So now they're going to have to censor the internet, right? So that we couldn't have this kind of conversation and have it broadcast over the internet because it's going to be something that's going to be, inflammatory or incite Muslim hatred or whatnot. I mean, they get very clever, but I think too complicated by half. For example, this thing about ISIS. ISIS was actually founded in 2012 by the Defense Intelligence Agency as a method of coping with the fact that Obama had been frustrated from lobbing cruise missiles into Syria in response to the gas attack, which was allegedly done by Assad on his own people. The Russians put the quietus to that with a 50-page documented report showing that actually it had been done by the rebels. And now in some of the Hillary emails that are trickling out, Not only was Hillary, the principal in motivating the assault on Libya, which was a complete massacre of a wonderful society, where Muammar Gaddafi was sharing the wealth of Libya with the Libyan people, national health care, national public education, national warehouses. Anyone who was hungry could go to one of these warehouses and obtain all the food they could ever need. If you had a healthcare problem couldn't be dealt with in Libya, he'd fly you and a friend or relative anywhere in the world, all expense paid by the government. He was undertaking the Great Waterworks Project that would have turned North Africa into a veritable oasis. And, sin of sins, the gold dinar, which would have rapidly become the currency of all of Africa. And it turns out in Hillary's emails, we learn that the real reasons for going into Libya were because the Western banking interests, read that Rothschilds, were upset that the gold dinar might become the currency. They wanted to put a halt to that, and that the French wanted to preserve Africa as their own preserve as a neo-colonial empire. So they came in, sent in mercenaries. They were paid three times for the same body, first to kill it, second to chop it up, third to burn it. Rape became systematic and ubiquitous, completely disgusting. I mean, before this event, there had been virtually no crime in Libya because everyone was having their needs satisfied by the government. Some of us think that's a proper function of government, to accommodate the needs of the people and then provide opportunities for their wants, their aspirations, their desires to fulfill themselves by means of various creative or other projects and undertakings. But this was just a slaughter of the people, and Hillary was a great cheerleader. It also turns out from her emails that we learned that the intervention in Syria had nothing to do with Assad allegedly abusing the people, but was to benefit Israel, which of course was the whole motivation behind 9/11, which appears to have originated in the fertile imagination of Bibi Netanyahu, who conducted a conference in Jerusalem even before the demise of the Soviet Union in 1990-91, published a book in 1987 entitled Terrorism, How the West Can Win, before the concept of terrorism was on anyone's mind. And we know that the members of the Project for a New American Century, most of whom were dual U.S.-Israeli citizens, believe there was a unique historical opportunity now with a dissolution of the Soviet Union if the United States would only move aggressively into that geopolitically sensitive area and exert military and diplomatic pressure outward from the Middle East, that we could create a new American empire that would endure for the next 100 years. These people moved largely into the Department of Defense when Bush and Cheney were elected through the rigged events in Florida, where Jeb Bush was the governor and all kinds of malfeasance was taking place there to ensure their victory, just as all kinds of malfeasance is taking place now to ensure Hillary's victory. This is all completely disgusting stuff. But where, the idea was to reverse American foreign policy from one in which, at least officially, we never attacked any nation that had not attacked us first, to one in which we became the greatest aggressor nation in the world, where Wesley Clark would eventually spell out what the plan covered of taking out seven governments in the next 5 years, beginning with Iraq and Libya, ending with Syria and Iran. Russia has stopped the assault on Syria by a brilliant move by Vladimir Putin, who appears to me to be the only true statesman astride the world stage today. But where Hillary's email revealed it was all being done to benefit Israel, that it wasn't Assad abusing his people, but to benefit Israel. And to further that plan, at Dartmouth College last year, she announced that if she became president of the United States, she would bomb Iran. Well, this is completely bizarre, Freeman. Although most Americans aren't aware, already in 2007, all 16 U.S. intel agencies concluded that Iran was not pursuing nuclear weapons, a conclusion they reaffirmed in 2011. The Mossad concluded in 2012 that Iran was not pursuing nuclear weapons, which it informed the Israeli government 3 weeks before Bibi Netanyahu went to the UN and announced precisely the opposite Moreover, these sanctions that we've imposed on Israel, on Iran, just as the sanctions we imposed on Iraq, are violations of Article 33 of the Geneva Conventions of 1949, which explicitly state that no person may be punished for a crime they did not personally commit. These are forms of collective punishment. In Iraq, it led to the deaths of some 500,000 Iraqi infants. Madeleine Albright, then Secretary of State, affirmed that it had been worth the effort, the death of those 500,000 infants to maintain this no-fly zone. And in Iran, it's simply absurd, because not only has Iran not been pursuing nuclear weapons, but Iran hasn't attacked any other nation since 1775. Just to put that in perspective, the ratification of the Constitution began in 1787. George Washington became president in 1789. So for longer than the United States has existed as a constitutional republic, Iran has not attacked any other nation. Yet Hillary's at Dartmouth talking about bombing Iran into the Stone Age. All of this is completely disgusting. And now you can see further. You see that the banking empire, the Rothschilds, had a key role here, even in the bizarre announcement by the AP on Monday before the primaries in California, New Jersey, Montana, North and South Dakota, New Mexico, that Hillary had already secured the nomination. That situation had not changed for 5 weeks. You only got there by counting the superdelegates. And of course, everyone knows Bernie's been contesting the role of the superdelegates. He pointed out that Hillary didn't have enough pledged delegates to secure the nomination then, nor does she today. She is still 180 delegates short to secure the nomination. So this was a blatant effort to manipulate, to suppress the vote. Many excellent commentators have noticed. Pat Cadell has talked about it, Chuck Todd, Chris Hedges, about the impropriety of this. So I looked into the ownership of the Associated Press. And while it represents 1,400 independent newspapers, the news that's distributed is controlled by six different huge corporations. They all get their news from either the AP or Reuters. And guess what? Reuters owns the AP. And guess what? The Rothschilds own Reuters. So clearly they're wanting to support the war candidate, Hillary, who will keep these ongoing intrusions into the Middle East going. Both Bernie and the Donald have expressed their dismay over the chaos we've created in the Middle East. Donald has remarked that he wishes we could get the $4 to $5 trillion we've expended there back. Bernie has lambasted Hillary for supporting the Iraqi invasion. And they are the anti-establishment candidates that the establishment on both sides do not want to see to come to power. And hence, you've had all of the disgusting activities on both sides, including, in the case of Bernie, by the way, not just this latest intervention, but if you go by the exit polls, I mean, in Europe, exit polls are used to determine the winner of an election, where the tabulated vote is merely a formal confirmation. Well, in Illinois, Bernie won the exit poll, but the state was given to Hillary. In Ohio, Bernie won the exit poll, but the state was given to Hillary. In Missouri, Bernie won the exit poll, but the state was given to Hillary. In Kentucky, where I live, my first position as a professor was at the University of Kentucky. Pike County is a very big coal county. And Pike County, like many other coal regions would have been voting heavily against Hillary, who talked about putting coal miners and coal mines out of business. They wiped clean the vote in Pike County in Kentucky and started counting again when they could manipulate and ensure that Bernie didn't get enough votes out of Pike County to actually win it. So that was another theft, which has been documented by a brilliant statistician by the name of Richard Charnin, who's actually published two books about the theft of elections using electronic voting machines, where when I was troubled by what was going on here in Wisconsin and was even in a studio of a local talk show host on Tuesday, 5 April, when the primary was taking place here, I was explaining how they were going to guarantee that Cruz beat Trump and that they'd presaged it by putting out a phony poll from the Marquette School of Law, which had less than 1,000 participants, but showed the result of a 20-point swing, because heretofore, Trump had been leading here in Wisconsin by 10 points. Now suddenly he was trailing Cruz by another 10. That's a preposterous change in public attitude, especially when you're talking about Trump supporters who have been dedicated to him through thick and through thin, and where I discovered that there was a far more extensive poll of all eight districts here in Wisconsin that had averaged over 1,000 participants apiece. In every one of those eight districts right up before the election, Trump was leading by like 62 to 37, I mean, over Cruz. I mean, it was just completely ridiculous what happened here in Wisconsin. And when I asked Charnin to look into it because of my suspicions, he confirmed, yes, that there are actually five different elections had been stolen here in Wisconsin, including the recall election to take out Scott Walker, judicial election involving a fellow named Presser, who was put on the Supreme Court, then his campaign reelection against Mary Burke, who was an excellent Democratic candidate, where we had an historic turnout, which traditionally favors Democrats, where they brought in Michelle twice, Barack, and even the big dog Bill Clinton. There was tremendous enthusiasm on the Democratic side for Mary Burke, and very little for Scott Walker, who's just committed a series of atrocities here in the state that have greatly damaged the reputation of Wisconsin. And yet it turned out that by a margin of 53 to 47, Walker won, when precisely the opposite should have been the case. When Richard Charnin looked into it, he discovered that they go to big counties that have lots of votes in order to rig these elections. And in Milwaukee County, which is a huge bastion of Democratic vote, it turned out the greater the number of votes that were cast, the greater percentage of the vote that went to Scott Walker. I mean, that's simply absurd. So that, you know, he has verified what happened in Kentucky as well. This guy's completely brilliant, Richard Charnin. So we've had this series of malfeasance taking place here to benefit Hillary Clinton, to tarnish Trump, and where now it turns out the standard practice, by the way, so you can't use exit polls to determine what actually has taken place, is to adjust the exit polls to conform to the tabulated vote, which means they're rendered useless, whereas in the past they've been a highly reliable guide to the actual winners and losers of elections, and whereas I've already observed in Europe, they're used to determine the winner.
Yeah. You know, we're looking at this, what seems to be a coup of some sort, or, you know, the final power grab. And you and I can see the psychological warfare that is occurring. It's almost easy for us because we know to look for these false flags. And then the masses eating up their Reuters mainstream, just they are so easily manipulated into this situation. We just had the Bilderbergers. We've got this whole thing coming out. We got Obama forming UN regional governors. We've got this mysterious claim on Iran, Iraq, why this region, why, and we're trying to sort out what this psychological warfare is leading to. And
well, it's very likely. I mean, Hillary is clearly a neocon. In fact, Obama turns out to be a neocon. You can tell because he surrounded himself by neocons. Victoria Nuland in the Department of State, neocon, married to one of the most prominent neocons. Samantha Power at the United Nations, a neocon. Ash Carter, Department of Defense, a neocon. Susan Rice, his own personal foreign policy, national security advisor, a neocon. I mean, it's all completely disgusting.
Let's not forget the CFR.
And the Council of Foreign Relations. You're absolutely right. I mean, you know, this is all very troubling stuff. If we come back to Orlando, the signs that this was a funny rigged event include the fact that the principal witness is a guy named Christopher Hansen. Now, listen, I've been getting emails all day, even beginning yesterday, about different aspects of this Orlando thing. And a fellow with whom I collaborate, I'm going to be doing a show of my own with him tonight by the name of Gary King, who had discovered that while I thought there were two different actors playing the role of a fellow named Jeff Bauman in Boston, where if you look through the smoke, when you're looking at these bodies and there's no blood, there's a guy in a hoodie who's attaching a fake bone prosthesis onto one of the alleged victims, who's not spurting any blood. I mean, you have if you had your legs blown off below the knees, that severs major arteries, you'd be spurting blood, you'd be unconscious in 1 minute, dead in two. He's actually assisting in attaching a false bone prosthesis to make the event look even more horrifying. The last thing you would do with someone with injuries like that is move them from the horizontal. You want to keep them flat, apply tourniquets. Instead, the Carlos Arredondo, the actor that Nathan Foulkes had identified, assists in moving him into a wheelchair. And while they're rushing him off in the wheelchair, the vibrations cause the false prosthesis to come loose and they have to stop and reattach it. Well, we knew that 19 days later, someone called Jeff Bauman shows up at a Boston Bruin games, only now he's lost his legs above the knee, Freeman. Interestingly, Jeff Bauman, number one on the scene at the time, was missing the little finger on his left hand. And it just so happens an Army lieutenant by the name of Nick Voigt had lost his legs below the knees and his little finger of his left hand in Afghanistan. But now you have a second Jeff Bauman who looks decidedly younger. He's holding a flag. He's got all his fingers, and now he's lost his legs above the knee. And would you believe, and this is what Gary discovered that I had not, even at the time I published the No and Nobody Died in Boston Either, there was a third Jeff Bauman who was wheelchaired out during a baseball game by none other than Carlos Arredondo, and this guy has no legs at all, not even thighs. I mean, if anyone had any doubt about whether or not this was done with amputee actors, I mean, there's about as conclusive proof as you could have. Three different amputee actors playing the same guy, Jeff Bauman. I turned it into a blog, too, as well as we have a YouTube about it. The YouTube is entitled Boston Strong, the three Jeff Baumans. The blog at jamesfetzer.blogspot.com is entitled Proof the Boston Bombing Was Staged in Three Easy Steps, number one, number two, number three. So I give you photographs of each of the three playing the same role of Jeff Bauman. I mean, this is embarrassingly bad. I thought that Boston was the most amateurish false flag, but now I'm beginning to wonder whether Orlando isn't going to rival or even surpass it. Because the same guy, Gary King, has discovered that this witness, Christopher Hansen, his actual name is Andrew Bowser, B-O-W-S-E-R, and he's an actor who has done a lot of commercials for RB. He's been on a show called My Pet Has Talent and a host of others. I mean, it's just simply ridiculous that you have this guy out there front and center. And, of course, a key proof I mentioned already is you got 50 police cars, but you have no ambulances. I mean, that's really an extremely telling sign. Gary has also pointed out to me that you don't have medical personnel dealing with the alleged bodies, which look very much like at the club in Paris, appear to be dummies, not real bodies, because you have these dummies lying on the floor, but there's no blood. And instead of the police or EMTs dealing with the bodies, it would normally be the EMTs, but you don't have a surge of EMTs there in Orlando any more than you had in Boston, any more than you had at Sandy Hook. They're allowing, you know, the bar owner or keeper or whatever, they close the door so cameras can't follow what's going on there. We don't have any actual photographs of any bodies. I don't know of any real blood. I have seen one or two persons being carried out, but they didn't appear to be injured so far as I could tell. So all this looks, you know, very much, very heavily staged.
Then, much like the Aurora shooting, we have a person reporting that there was a man inside holding the door shut, not allowing people to leave. In an Aurora shooting, we had reports of two crisscrossing CS canisters coming from opposite doors and someone standing at the door to open it for James to enter.
Yeah. You're absolutely right, Freeman. You're spot on. And yes, there are reports now that there were several shooters, not just the one. Hillary and the major media. Now, bear in mind, as I said before, the major media is controlled. It's six different corporations. They get all their news from AP and Reuters. Reuters owns AP, and Reuters in turn is owned by the Rothschilds. So if the Rothschilds want Hillary, they're going to do whatever they can to benefit Hillary. Now, I think in this instance, it may not play out that way, because another point made by this former ambassador to the United States from Israel, Michael Oren, is that he believes this is going to give Trump a boost because it involves Muslims, although Obama isn't even willing to talk about it, and where Trump, of course, proposed a temporary ban until he can figure out what's going on here. I think he's right. I think it is going to give a boost to Trump's candidacy. But look at what Hillary's doing. You're reporting what she's, you know, going all over before Americans have any chance to think it through, trying to capitalize, you know, get as much political benefit out of this apparently staged event as she possibly can before the world catches up with what's going on.
Absolutely. I mean, she is this whole statement of stopping lone wolves. I mean, these type of open intel control situations to play upon everybody's emotions at this moment. And then also the psychological manipulation of this homosexual situation, where now you're left mourning the homosexual situation and confused in the Muslim situation because of Obama. I mean, that's what I'm always looking at, is the psychological warfare. Yeah. Where are they guiding us? What are they doing?
Yeah. 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 Well, Obama's history, I mean, you know, Donald was savage for raising the birther issue, but my own research has established that he actually was born in Kenya, that they even went out of their way to create a fake Kenyan birth certificate. So if you start talking about the birth certificate from Kenya, they could say, oh, yeah, but it's been debunked and shown to be a fake. The fake has, you know, the wrong officials. It doesn't even have Kenya properly identified by its formal technical name at the time. The bona fide one actually has a footprint of the little fresh-born baby on the birth certificate. I had done a long show about the Hawaiian birth certificate on The Real Deal when it was still a radio show, where I just made the transition in January of 2015, recognizing the benefits of being able to actually show the evidence I'm talking about. Show, for example, where you can see through the smoke and you see bodies with missing limbs, but there is no blood. Show a picture of Jeff Bauman, number one, where his legs are missing below the knee. He's got this fake bone extension of Jeff Bauman, number two, where now his legs are missing above the knee of Bluff Jeff Bauman, number three, where now he has no legs at all, actually to be able to show them instead of merely describe them. So when I had the opportunity to go to NBC, I leaped at it because I knew how much more powerful it would make my presentations, being able to actually present the evidence I was talking about. Now, Preston James, who writes for Veterans Today, has written a very, very good piece about what happened in Orlando. He thinks it's possible this was an MK Ultra operator if the shooting was real, which I think is yet to be established, but that the agency, the CIA, has these individuals who are under their control, mentally under their control, mind control operatives. A thousand of them scattered all over the country. So if they want to have a shooting event, they can, you know, simply take control of one of these individuals and get him in there to do whatever they want him to do.
Well, everything we heard about James Holmes would lead you to that conclusion. Yes. I mean, he was standing outside the building waiting to be arrested, not knowing why he was even standing there. He made full confessions of his mind control while in jail, reported by one of the other inmates, of course, completely ignored by mainstream.
Freeman, you're completely right. Sirhan is maybe an even more perfect example. He, a psychiatrist, actually boasted of having hypnotized Sirhan for the CIA. He had all this almost automatic writing, RFK must die, RFK must die, and all that, you know, totally manipulated. And then he fired 8 shots with his revolver, whereas as many as 14 were fired in the pantry, and Bobby was hit 4 times from behind. Actually, one of the 4 shots passed through his clothing, didn't actually hit his body, but then he was hit several times in the upper back. One of the shots appears to have entered from under his armpit. and one is back and lodged in his cervical vertebrae. But he was killed by a shot behind the right ear, fired from only about an inch and a half. And it was the same caliber, same type of gun Sirhan had used. But Sirhan never got anywhere near close enough to have fired any of those shots. And, of course, was in front of him instead of behind him. And would you believe when the autopsy report by Thomas Noguchi, who is a world-famous medical examiner, established that Bobby had been killed by shots from behind because it was in conflict with the official L.A. police report, where Daryl Gates, as I recall, ran the L.A. department with an iron hand. Noguchi was fired. I mean, it's simply absurd. The medical examiner's report, the autopsy report, is the basis for any legal investigation of a crime. So instead, they reversed the procedure, fired the coroner because he'd actually figured out the true cause of death was not that it exonerated Sirhan from having killed Bobby. I mean, it's one of the most disgusting cases of all time. And Sirhan is in complete absence of any memory whatsoever of what happened during the shooting. He had no idea. It does appear there was a woman there in a polka dot dress that was a psychological trigger for him to start shooting. But it's clear he was a diversion. He wasn't the actual assassin of Bobby Kennedy. So you're making a good point, yes, with Holmes in Aurora, and now with this fellow here in who even has a Muslim name.
Omar Mateen.
I know, Omar Mateen.
He is
Omar Mir Sadiq Mateen, 29, born in the U.S. He's a U.S. citizen, the son of Afghan immigrants, and had a Florida security officer license. He'd been employed since 2007 at a private security company, G4S, that provides security to federal buildings. I mean,
he had aspirations to be a police officer. He was college trained, you know. But then his dad is putting out somewhat of a hate speech video show as well.
I have a report that his father claims to be the president of Afghanistan and that he's on very cordial terms with the Taliban.
Well, there you go. I mean, Jim, this just,
And how could Barack Obama say we have no idea as to what his motivation?
Right.
It was a hate crime and involved weapons, so we got to get rid of the weapons, you know. It's been observed, by the way, that if he wanted to bring about maximum casualties, he could have set fire to the building. That's been a technique that's proven tried and true in the past for getting a lot of people killed. And he seems to have, like Adam Lanza at Sandy Hook, a phenomenal kill-to-target ratio, where he's just stunningly good with this weapon, this AR-15 he's alleged to have used.
Right. Now, I have fired an AR-15, and the one that I had was, like you were saying, semi-automatic, where the kick of the rifle forced your arm, because there was no trigger. It was a handle at the end of the barrel, and when it kicked, it would cause that handle to move back and forth and give you somewhat of an automatic shot. Now, I released 30 bullets in less than 30 seconds out of that thing, but there was no way that I could have aimed it.
Right. That's always been one of the classic objections, the alleged official scenario of Lee Oswald firing three shots in Dealey Plaza with a Mannlicher Carcano in 6.5 seconds. I mean, it's just ridiculous. The best sniper in the Marine Corps, Gunny Carlos Hathcock, tried to replicate the shooting at Quantico, where they set it up with the right distance, dimensions, and all that. And he quite reasonably inferred that if he couldn't do it, how could a mediocrity like Oswald, who didn't even, he barely qualified in 1959 with a 190-01, 190 is the min for qualifying as marksman. There are three ranks of shooters qualification. Marksman, sharpshooter, which begins from 210 to 219, expert 220 up on a 250-point scale, where you're firing five shots at a series of different combinations of locations and targets. Well, actually, batches of 10, five different shooting locations. You have to different range position, whether you're kneeling or prone or whatnot. And he was a mediocre shot. There was no evidence he'd actually ever practiced marksmanship, which is a heavily practiced dependent. The weapon was a piece of junk. It was known as the humanitarian rifle during World War II for never actually harming anyone on purpose. But, you know, over and beyond that, Freeman, we've established, and, you know, I've done a huge amount of work on JFK, publishing three monster books that shattered the medical cover-up with the best people to ever study the case. JFK was hit four different times. He was hit in the back from behind, a shallow shot that went in about 5.5 inches below his collar, just to the right of the spinal column, that appears to have been fired from the top of the county records building by a Dallas deputy sheriff, by the way. He was hit in the throat by a shot that actually passed through the windshield that appears to have been fired from inside the triple underpass by an Air Force expert by the name of Jack Lawrence. And then he was, after the driver, William Greer, pulled the limousine to the left and to a halt to make sure JFK would be killed, he was hit in the back of the head by one of three shots fired from the Daltex by an anti-Castro Cuban by the name of Nestor Tony Escadro, who was, believe it or not, supervised by George H.W. Bush, who would be arrested coming out of the building, identify himself as an independent Texas oilman, Houston oilman, taken downtown in question, but then released with no record kept. But I discovered he had been captured in a photograph standing in front of the book depository that afternoon, where he is eventually joined by Edward Lansdale, U.S. Air Force general responsible for assassinations all over the world, who many of us believe actually set up the JFK hit by positioning the shooters and determining the sequence of shots. And then finally, Jack was hit in the right temple. After he was hit in the back of the head, he slumped forward. Jack eased him back up, was looking him right in the face when he was hit in the right temple by frangible or exploding bullet that set up shockwaves that blew his brains out the back of his already weakened cranium to the left rear with such force that when they impacted with motorcycle officer Bobby Hargis riding there, he initially thought he himself had been shot. And then Jack slumped to the left. Now, we know the shooter in that case, too, who turns out to be Frank Sturgis, who was a CIA mafia kind of guy. He was a really remarkable marksman. He was arrested by a New York City Gold Shield detective by the name of James Rothstein, Jim Rothstein, when he came to New York and to the apartment of Marita Lawrence with the intent to kill her before she could testify before the House Select Committee on Assassinations, which was reinvestigating the case in 1976-77. And when he entered the apartment, Rothstein put a gun up to his head and took him into custody. He gave him the throwaway line, good shooting, and Sturgis started talking about how actually he had been aiming for his eye, but he moved slightly so that he hit him in the temple instead, and that he was willing to take him out because he'd betrayed the brigade at the Bay of Pigs, which was false, but a convenient belief for the CIA allowed them to maintain. And because he was cavorting with women who were spies for other countries, without actually what's true. But we have, you know, knowledge of a great deal about what happened. Not only what happened to JFK, there were other shooters there, too. There was a Dallas policeman by the name of Roscoe White, who was on the grassy knoll, had the easiest shot. He was connected to the CIA, but he appears to have pulled his shot because he would have hit Jackie. They were under strict instruction. Jackie should not be harmed. And there was another shooter who was in the book depository, but not on the east side where the Oswald was alleged to have been located, the so-called assassin's lair from which no shots were fired, but on the opposite side of the building, firing at John Connally in the mistaken belief that it was LBJ's the liberal senator from Texas, Ralph Yarborough, whom LBJ despised, but he had a huge argument with JFK that morning, wanting to get Connally out and Yarborough in, but JFK overrode him on the ground that the chief executive of the state should ride with the chief executive of the United States. Those shots were fired by Malcolm Mack Wallace, who was Lyndon's personal hitman, who killed at least a dozen people for Lyndon, including one of his own sisters.
And meanwhile, Woody Harrelson's dad claims to fire the killing shot.
Well, Woody Harrelson's dad was there. I didn't know if we needed to take a break right now, Freeman, because it's the top of the hour. But you tell me. In any case, We can go back all the way to the trademark where Lee Oswald was handing out those pamphlets for the Fair Play brochure. It's just a single flyer, really, for the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, which, of course, was a pro-Castro organization that wanted to have a more even-handed treatment of Cuba to make him look like he was a pro-Castro communist sympathizer. But he's surrounded by a lot of right-wingers who are active in the anti-Castro movement, including the father of Ted Cruz. So that Rafael Cruz is actually there in the middle of the shot on the far left, and it's sometimes cropped out or partially cropped in many of the photographs, is actually a man who appears to be Michael Payne, who is married to Ruth Payne. They were both tied to the CIA. Ruth Payne arranged for Lee to have a position at the book depository just 2 weeks before the motorcade would come past. And on the far right, a short fellow, but very, very interesting, by the name of Chauncey Marvin Holt, whom I got to know personally. Chauncey prepared 15 sets of Ford Secret Service credentials for use in and around Dealey Plaza. By his handler, Philip Twombly. He was living out in Southern California, working at the Los Angeles Stamp and Stationery Store. It was like a five-story building, and the bottom three was a legit business, and the top two was a CIA ID op. And they prepared, for example, the Alec Heidel identification that Lee was using in New Orleans. But Chauncey was worried that he might not get the color-coded pins that the agents wore from one assignment to another in time. But he did get that information too. So he prepared this 15 sets of Ford Secret Service credentials. Went to Dealey Plaza. He was supposed to leave them in a red pickup truck that would be parked behind the grassy knoll, which most Americans don't realize was a parking lot used by the Dallas police. But when he got there, the pickup truck wasn't there. He wandered around Dealey Plaza. He told me he saw more bad guys, more mercenaries and assassins than you'd find at a Soldiers of Fortune convention. He went back and the pickup truck was there. He left the documents and proceeded in the company of Charles Harrelson, who, as you observe, was Uri Harrelson's father, and a man he knew as Richard Montoya, whose true identity is Richard Rogers. Charles Rogers, and they proceeded down behind the parking lot to the railroad yard there. They'd been instructed that there would be a boxcar that would appear to be locked, but actually would not be. They climbed in and found all kinds of ammunition, explosives, and weapons there. The train started to pull out, and they thought they were free. But in fact, the supervisor of the railroad yard thought something was wrong and pulled him back, and the police apprehended them, walked them through Dealey Plaza. So you have this escort, military escort, where in the front is Charles Rogers, short, very well dressed, then the tallest, Charles Harrelson, father of Woody, then the third, not E. Howard Hutt, often misidentified, but rather Chauncey Marvin Holt, of the three. And in some of the photographs, there's a civilian who walks beside them who has a distinctive height, gait, and hand, left hand with a distinctive ring, who's been identified by no less authorities than L. Fletcher Prouty, who was the liaison between the CIA and the White House for covert actions, and Victor Krulak, one of the most revered of all Marine Corps generals, as being Edward Lansdale. So we actually have this photograph of Lansdale walking past the so-called three tramps, where I'm convinced, Freeman, by the way, that if Lee hadn't panned out as the patsy, that they would have been fingered because of all those explosives and weapons and ammunition in the boxcar. So it was a plan B. But of course, Lee did pan out. And then we have a third photograph where Edward Lansdale is waiting to speak to George H.W. Bush. And actually, I believe I was the very first person to identify Bush in that photograph. I found it in a collection, a paperback book that was sold only in 7-Eleven stores that had been put together by Jesse Curry, who was the chief of police of Dallas at the time, and which was, he became the security, the head of security for 7-Eleven stores. And it was sold only there. And I was just stunned when I noticed in this photograph this very familiar figure, the right height, weight, build, so forth, clothing, his head tilted forward, hands in the pocket characteristically. I mean, there was no doubt it was George H.W. Bush. And of course, we put a whole lot together more. Anyone who's curious about this aspect of Bush having actually supervised the Daltech's hit team, you want to check out a completely brilliant article by Richard Hooke, H-O-O-K-E, entitled, Did George H.W. Bush Coordinate a JFK Hit Team? To which the answer appears to be yes.
Yes. Yes, folks, the facts are out there. So let's not get our history from made-for-TV movies, because we are dealing with some serious psychological warfare as they manipulate this scenario and scene over and over again. We can almost predict the events that are coming. I mean, we have, and we can see the agenda. So as Jim Fetzer and I and many others try to bring this to light, we are clearly trying to seek the end game, the agenda for all of this. And as we get back to this puzzle, we're going to go straight to that. Absolutely. What do you have coming up right now, Jim?
Well, actually, I'm doing several. You know, my show tonight is actually going to be on Orlando with Gary King, who discovered all this information about this guy, the principal witness who turns out to be an actor. We had a parallel phenomenon at Sandy Hook, by the way, with this fellow Gene Rosen, who turns out is not just an actor, Freeman, but get this, he'd actually gone around the country giving lectures to promote gun control on behalf of FEMA before the Sandy Hook event.
Wow.
Now, get his story. He claims that four or five kids were dropped off by a bus driver in front of his home. And I'd been there. His home is immediately beside the firehouse, which is about a third of a mile up the road on Dickinson Drive from where the school had stood. By the time I visited the locale with Wolfgang Halbig, for where we'd gone in order to speak before the school board that was having a meeting that day, I checked out, you know, these locations, and Gene Rosen's story is completely incredible. I mean, he wasn't the parent or the custodian of any of these children, so why would a bus driver be dropping off children at the home of someone who was not their parent or custodian? He claims he took them in to the house, and they played with stuffed animals and drank orange juice until they started talking about what had happened. He claims he heard shots from the school, but didn't call in, didn't make a 911 call. And, you know, what's a grown man like him doing with stuffed animals anyway? You know, the whole idea is completely ridiculous. Plus, the number of students that would have been there that day, according to the official report by Steven Sedensky, who was the state's attorney for Danbury, there should have been 486 students there. If you subtract 489 students there, if you subtract the 20 who were supposed to have been killed, 469. But we have no evidence of any evacuation of any kids. I mean, the reason, of course, being the school actually had been abandoned in 2008, and there were no kids there. But if you look at the locations and times that the police claim evacuation was taking place, we have dash cam footage. And it shows that those locations and times, there's nothing going on. I mean, there are no kids there. Now, it's sometimes claimed you can't prove a negative, but that's just wrong. You can prove there's no elephant in your living room, for example, by going there right now and looking for signs of the presence of elephant. If you find no signs of the presence of elephant in your living room, you're entitled to infer that's because there's no elephant there. If you're looking at the location and time for an evacuation was supposed to be taking place and there are no kids there, that entitles you to infer that's because no evacuation was taking place. There are actually as many as 70 other staff members, secretaries, custodial staff, you know, cafeteria workers. They never materialized either. There is this celebrated photograph that appears to show a policewoman escorting a string of about 15 kids away from the school that appeared on the cover of virtually every newspaper in the world at the time. It was taken by Newtown Bee associate editor and photographer Shannon Hicks. Now, you know, that photograph was like the single most important piece of evidence that anyone had that something had actually happened at Sandy Hook. Well, it turns out that there was a second photograph she took, which she actually temporarily took before the photograph that went around the world. And it shows that there's a whole bunch of parents there that are looking on with their arms crossed, their hands in the pockets, very casually, while the policewoman rearranges the children in the line to get a better shot. In the earlier photograph, there's a little girl in a pink sweater and a skirt who's at the head of the line. In the photograph that's set around the world, it's a little boy taller in a dark sweater and blue jeans at the head of the line. Can you imagine that this was an actual emergency situation where they're seeking to flee from a demented gunman? They would stop and rearrange the kids to get a better shot. And what are parents doing there? Did someone during this event taking place, like, gee, I better call and get some parents down here? And how would they decide which parents to call? If there's supposed to be 489 kids there, who would you call? I mean, it's all completely ridiculous. This was totally staged. Actually, if you look in the background of the photograph, you can actually see two women that are just looking on casually while all this is taking place, to whom I refer as lounging at the massacre. I mean, this is all ridiculous. Shannon Hicks, by the way, has acknowledged she took both of those photographs, where the second completely discredits the first. It's a principle in the law, by the way, Freeman, in making a case, that if any element of the case, any material element of the case is fraudulent, you can dismiss the whole case on the grounds that fraud vitiates the entire case. I mean, you know, that there's an element of fraud or fakery. Well, Sandy Hook abounds with fraud and fakery. In fact, we discovered that was a two-day FEMA drill, that they had a rehearsal on the 13th, going live on the 14th. There was even a manual, a set of instructions for the event, which we have, which I made the first appendix of the book, Nobody Died at Sandy Hook, and which explains why there were so many oddities in some of the photographs. For example, we had pictures of pizza cartons and bottled water at the firehouse. We had a sign that said everyone must check in. We had porta potties present. Well, it says right in the manual, everyone must check in. And of course, for any FEMA event, you have to have restrooms and refreshments. Then you had a whole lot of people there with name tags on lanyards. Well, that's standard for a FEMA drill, because the lanyards, the name tags are color coded to identify the role you're playing in the event. Then we had parents bringing children to the event. Can you imagine any parent bringing a child to the scene of a child shooting massacre? But it was the rehearsal, so that it was being treated as a festive event. Nobody actually knew what was going to take place. In fact, well, some of the participants on the 13th became confused over the dates, so that they put up donation websites for the survivors already on the 13th, the day before it officially occurred. And Adam Lanza's date of death was initially recorded in the Social Security death indexes, having happened on the 13th, making his feat in shooting 20 children and 6 adults the following day all the more remarkable.
Yes.
I mean, Freeman, it's just astonishing.
It's
true of other of these events, and true in general. When you have a true hypothesis, in particular in this instance, that was faked, yeah, more and more evidence will turn up that confirms it. In this case, that includes the discovery of a fellow by the name of David Wheeler, who was playing two roles that day. Both he and his wife Francine were B-grade actors. And on the day of Sandy Hook, David Wheeler was playing the role of a grieving parent, but he was also playing the role of a SWAT team member. So he's marching up and down Dickinson Drive carrying a weapon upside down by the magazine frame. I mean, this is so absurd. And there's no question that it's the same person. I mean, you can find it, online, exposing, blowing apart the case. Just do a search on David Wheeler. Well, we'll get this. Not only was he playing those two roles, but Barack Obama flew him and his wife down to Washington and gave her the opportunity to give a pitch for gun control from the Oval Office, a benefit he's only also bestowed upon Joe Biden, the vice president of the United States, where Francine talked about gun control. The whole idea of this enterprise had been to create a cadre of anti-gun lobbyists with seemingly impeccable credentials. Turns out Francine is actually the former personal assistant to Maureen White, who was the national finance chairman for the Democratic National Committee, 1 year raising $51 million. She was her personal assistant, which has now led me to conclude that even the Democratic National Committee may have been involved in this event. We knew from a press conference given by the Governor Malloy of Connecticut the day of the shooting. He said that he and the lieutenant governor had been spoken to, that something like this might happen, leading me to reason, spoken to by whom? Something like this? What could he possibly mean? There are only really two alternatives. One, that he'd been warned that someone was going to go berserk and shoot up a Connecticut school, in which case he had the obligation as governor to warn the school districts to elevate their level of security to ensure that did not take place. But he didn't do that. Alternatively, he'd been informed that they were going to take an abandoned school, conduct a drill, and present it as a live event to promote gun control, which is exactly what happened. And lo and behold, when I looked into it, on the 27th of November, who should visit the governor in Connecticut but Eric Holder, then the attorney general, of course, who is playing an instrumental role here in setting all of this up. Eric Holder is long known as an anti-gun zealot. In fact, we even had footage of him addressing a National Democratic Women's Conference in Washington, D.C. in 1995, saying that we have to brainwash, that's his word, not mine, brainwash the American people to change their attitudes toward guns. I think the Sandy Hook event was a part of a brainwashing where he played a crucial role. We now have Loretta Lynch in office. And there's a lot of speculation whether Loretta Lynch is going to bring forward an indictment of Hillary Clinton for her email scandals, which the evidence of which has just grown over and over and over again. It turns out, Freeman, she didn't even have a password on her server, that she even published the names of CIA covert operatives, which, of course, compromised their lives by doing so. When Scooter Libby and Dick Cheney revealed that, you know, the wife of Ambassador Joe Wilson, who'd exposed their claims that Saddam Hussein was obtaining yellow cake to make nuclear weapons from Libya, he outed her wife Valerie Plame as running as a covert agent. She was in the most delicate position in the entire American intelligence arsenal because she was maintaining an offline, unofficial, but, you know, essential program to inhibit the proliferation of nuclear weapons in the Middle East. But Cheney and Libby were so shallow and so vain that just to punish Joe Wilson, they exposed Valerie Plame in the most sensitive intelligence network in the United States' entire intelligence system, leading to the deaths of many of those who had been involved in the complete destruction of the system. So here you have now Loretta Lynch, where this whole thing involving the Associated Press announcement that Hillary was the designated nominee of the Democratic Party the night before the vote in California, New Hampshire, New Mexico, North and South Dakota, and Montana was completely improper. We have a host of experts who've confirmed how improper it was, including Pat Caddell, Chuck Todd, Chris Hedges. Chuck Todd on MSNBC, which is, of course, wholeheartedly supporting Hillary Clinton. Chuck Todd, who also hosts Meet the Press, which has become a daily as well as a Sunday feature, said he thought it was very serious that the AP had done this and that he thought it deserved discussion. Well, when I looked into the who is the AP, that while officially it's 1,400 independent newspapers, all the news they publish comes from, they publish is dominated by six corporations that determine what actually gets into print, that the corporation gets their information officially from the AP and Reuters. But it turns out that Reuters owns the AP and the Rothschilds own Reuters. So basically, you got the Rothschilds controlling all the information that gets into the American media. We knew from William Colby, who not long before he died in a bizarre kayaking incident where he had uneaten food still on the table, that the agency owns everyone of significance in the mainstream media. That includes all kinds of people like Wolf Blitzer, Anderson Cooper. You run down your list, and I'm now convinced that it includes several members of MSNBC. I've been very troubled by Lawrence O'Donnell and his conduct here. It's been ridiculous. Even Rachel Maddow, I suspect, may have, they praise her as supposed to be the smartest person on television. Well, that's not my opinion. Rachel hasn't figured out that JFK wasn't killed by Lee Oswald. She hasn't figured out 19 Islamic terrorists didn't attack the United States on 9/11. She hasn't figured out that Sandy Hook was an elaborate hoax. She hasn't figured out that the Boston bombing was, in fact, an extremely amateurish false flag. And I'm most certain tonight she's going to go on and on about Orlando and how Hillary is absolutely right. We have to ban guns as though, you know, the guns were homophobic. I mean, what if he burned down the building? Would we then want to ban matches?
Right.
We have these cases where somebody drives a car into a bunch of pedestrians and kills a lot of them on purpose. Should we ban automobiles? If airplanes were used as weapons, which is the official story of 9/11, should we ban airplanes? I mean, this is just stupid beyond belief, Freeman.
Absolutely.
But not this time.